Hi, I'm Nathan Ryder, and welcome to the Viva Survivors podcast, where I talk to PhD graduates about their research, their Viva, and life after the PhD. This is episode 61, and today I'm talking to Dr. Tom Mitchell, who recently completed his PhD in sports psychology at Liverpool John Moores University. Tom's research looks at identity in professional football. He had his Viva in February of this year. He's now a senior lecturer in sport coaching at Leeds Beckett University. Well, it's great to welcome Tom to the podcast today. So thank you for joining me, Tom.
No problem. Thanks very much.
And to begin with, can you tell us a little bit about your research for your PhD and how you came to do it?
Yeah, well, the research for my PhD, the title's Identity in Professional Football, and the research surrounds the development of the person as a result of being exposed to football environments, so young players being in academy systems for long periods of time. And it really focuses on how does being in that system develop you as a person, and how does that subsequently increase or decrease the chances of making that transition from youth to professional, because we know that not many do, and that's kind of a bit of an industry concern and an industry problem that can go right the way to the England national team. Prior to doing any kind of PhD related research, I worked for probably 5-6 years at an FE college, and we were subcontracted by League Football Education to deliver BTEC programmes to apprentices at a local football club. And that ended up being something that I was really interested in doing. And so for 5 years, I delivered these programmes to young apprentices and saw people come in and out the system. And I was kind of really interested in who is it that actually makes it professional. And it wasn't often the most technically gifted players. It was something about the person. So that was really interesting for me as someone who's teaching these people and being in and around the academy system, but then also from a research perspective, I really wanted to kind of explore that more. What is it about the person that gets these people contracts, and then can clubs kind of try to develop that and increase their chances of getting more people through their systems?
Can you say what part of the UK were you working in when you kind of I'm asking that in that way because I don't know if there's any kind of confidentiality
I worked for Doncaster College for 12 years. We had the contract for the Doncaster Rovers apprentices, and that's normal up and down the country. It's usually the local college that delivers the education aspect to apprentices. So yeah, it was there.
How did that transition then into the PhD? So you'd found something that was interesting you. What made you then think about doing research?
I did a master's degree at Leeds Metropolitan at the time in sport and exercise science. Went straight into teaching from that. So it's kind of 5 or 6 years later where at the institution that I was at, they wanted to develop their HE provision, so do more degree programmes and foundation degrees. But they weren't really equipped staff-wise to fully do that. So they were part-funding PhD programmes. So basically, I applied for some funding to do one, and then it was up to me to kind of look around for an institution. So I had a look around, and I knew a few people at Liverpool John Moores, and they're quite prominent in the area of sort of football science and football psychology. So I contacted them, and we set up a meeting, discussed my idea, and it was very similar to kind of things that they were interested in at the time. So it kind of, it was a good match.
Yeah. And I think I remember, because I'm based near Liverpool, I remember Liverpool John Moores came out very, very well in the last ref when it came to sports science, didn't it? Was it the top in the country?
They were there or thereabouts.
Yeah.
Jim manipulated the odd stat, they were top or second. So, yeah, they're very good on research, very sort of, they have a lot of international collaboration and a lot of national collaboration. So yeah, they're very good.
As your research matured then, so you came across this idea when you were seeing people who in some respects, are at the start of their career or potentially at the start of a career in football. Was your research for your PhD focused just on that aspect, or were you looking at people like throughout the professional career?
Yeah, I mean the main one was trying to understand the types of people that got a professional contract. So when they're 18, is a big sort of transition point to whether a club will typically offer you a professional contract or not. So I saw a lot more people who didn't get a professional contract than did, but I was actually more interested in the people that did get contracts. You know, that's the aim of the game. That's the football club's business, is to get people through into their professional team. So I was interested in trying to support clubs in maximising that, really.
And so how practically were you going about this research? Because I'm guessing, like, with any kind of research, with any kind of PhD, there's a lot of reading involved, but were you meeting people one-to-one to interview them and assess them in some way, or how did all that side of things work?
Yeah, I mean, it probably took about a year from enrolment to actually doing any data collection. We were trying to refine the best way of going about it. So there were three phases, really, to my data collection. The first bit was going down, I guess, the more traditional sports psychology route, which was psychometrics. Right. So there is an athletic identity measurement scale, which is, you know, a validated psychometric out there that's in existence. It's been used with sort of North American student athletes. So athletic identity is essentially how much you relate to the athlete roles, how much you might perceive yourself as a footballer, more so than maybe a brother or a son or those kind of other roles in your life. And in North America, they kind of tried to use the athletic identity measurement scale as a predictor for those that may have difficulty in transitioning away from the sport, or may have difficulty when they're injured, and those kind of things. So it was kind of it was designed to kind of identify those kind of potential issues. So young footballers, being arguably student athletes, so they have to do a program, they have to do training towards a sport. It fitted quite well. So we gave a psychometric scale to 168 youth footballers across, I think, probably 20 clubs or something like that. So we got quite a good sample. So the first study was kind of a very traditional psychometric based. So we found players that were in year one and two differed in that kind of athletic identity. Players at different clubs, there was quite a lot of inter-club variance. So essentially that was the first bit of data collection, was a psychometric. Luckily, I've got quite a few contacts within football, I was able to contact quite a few clubs, which was good. And then we did move on to interviews. So I went around probably 10 clubs interviewing people like academy managers, academy coaches, heads of recruitment, at clubs who are kind of huge Premier League clubs down to smaller League Two clubs, to try and get their perspectives on what is the type of person that generally makes it.
Yeah.
And then the third bit of data collection was more ethnographic, really. I went into one particular club one day a week for a season and repeat interviewed a couple of different players. It was three players, really, that I repeatedly interviewed them every so often, and to find out kind of how's it going, what's going on in the workplace, how is the workplace challenging you. So you might have players that maybe were injured and unable to play. So how did they cope with that? How did their identity serve them in coping with things like that? Uncertainty around contracts, uncertainty. The club I was at, there was a changing manager, so it created a lot of uncertainty. And I was managing to capture lots of those experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So, quite varied data collection, which probably came about through my confidence and ability, I guess.
Yeah, from all that kind of the variety of data that you got, what were the main outcomes from your research then?
Yeah, the main outcomes from the research were that a strong sense of knowing who you are and a strong sense of identity, if you like, can act as a really useful resource during times of challenge. For example, being injured, not getting a professional contract, a changing manager, those kind of things. You can draw upon yourself. So if you've got good values of kind of hard work and determination that underpin your behaviours, then you can use it as a bit of a barrier to cope with these challenges. But what I did find was that the football club culture and working practices probably don't often allow for that to happen.
Right.
It's quite an institutionalised environment where it's quite easy just to go with the flow and do what the coach says or do what the manager says and conform to everything. And then that kind of stifles the development of a strong, flexible, clear sense of who you are and ultimately a resource. So I found there was a bit of an incongruence between what clubs want from a player and the strategies they actually put in place to create that in a player.
Yeah.
So that were kind of the main things coming out of the PhD. So moving forward, it's kind of what is the right climate then?
Yeah, and is that something you're interested in pursuing now?
Yeah, definitely.
Developing the research.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, certainly I want to generate further understanding of cultural practices and why they come about. So that can lead down kind of research routes for coach development. How did coaches get to think these practices were useful and were helpful? And then also, yeah, it's understanding the effect of practices on players a little bit more. And ultimately then, I guess the main thing is, can you kind of shape the environment to actually maximise the impact of developing people?
Yeah. Well, that sounds really interesting. And it also sounds like something that would have, I mean, a wider impact than just professional football as well.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say any professional sport, I suppose maybe big business, but certainly professional sport in general, where it is intense and but you do need resourceful people that are self-reliant and take responsibility. And sometimes the intensity of professional football, it's quite hard to kind of develop those characteristics.
Yeah. Were you part-time or full-time during your PhD?
Yeah, I did it arguably the hard way, really. I did it part-time whilst working full-time.
Yeah.
So,
And was that... Because I noticed... Oh, sorry.
No, that's all. Yeah, you go on.
I was going to notice, because obviously you're a senior lecturer at Leeds Beckett University now. Was that what you were doing? Were you at Leeds Beckett during some of your PhD? Or?
No, I started... When I was started the PhD when I was a lecturer at Doncaster College in the University Centre there, mm-hmm. and it wasn't until just before my viva really that I managed to get a position at Leeds Beckett University.
Okay.
So I think having a PhD submitted and a viva date and then my teaching experience, you know, it was I was good to go at Leeds having interviewed.
So what? What was it like then preparing for your viva? Both, I suppose initially you submitted and you must have been, I guess, applying for the Leeds Beckett job and maybe others. And then you starting a job before you had your viva. What was it like preparing for it in that kind of circumstances?
Yeah, well, I think like I alluded to earlier, it's... I think I arguably did it the hard way. We're just working full time, so you're doing the entire thesis on an evening or on a weekend, and then I did it over a 7-year period, and started it before having children, and then you end up getting near the end of it and having children, and your time squeezed quite a lot, and preparing for the viva was just a continuation of that, really. It was I actually left it alone for a good couple of weeks, left the thesis alone, didn't look at it, didn't really think about it until a couple of weeks before the viva. And then it was a case of, let's act as a reviewer on it. So I acted as my own reviewer in a way, having spent a bit of time away from the thesis. And I kind of reviewed each study as if I was a peer reviewer, as if it was a journal submission. So I tried to think about, well, what questions would a reviewer ask? You know, is it theoretically sound? Have I justified everything I've done? Have I made claims that are actually from the results rather than more grander claims that may not specifically be related to the results? And I kind of tried to review it. I spoke to my director of studies. I spoke to other members of the supervisory team about their viva experiences of their own PhDs and if they've actually been an examiner in a viva. So I kind of got the types of questions that, that may come up. And then we also looked at, as a team, we also looked at the examiners who are actually going to be there and tried to anticipate the types of questions that, that they might ask us. So it was quite, looking back now, it was quite well planned, really. We did quite a lot of work on the whole process, really, not just reviewing the thesis, but actually looking at what the day's going to look like and what types of questions are these reviewers going to be asking.
Yeah, it's really interesting the way that you've framed that as well, because it sounds like you were supported quite well by your supervisory team. You know, a lot of people that I talk to, they don't feel like they were abandoned in any way, but in terms of the support they get from their supervisors, it really is, they might have a mock viva or they might have a couple of meetings and discuss questions, but the kind of picture that you paint seems more developed than that.
Yeah, I felt really well supported throughout the entire process. One thing for me that I had was a consistent supervisory team, and other people I spoke to, I've spoken to their experiences, they've had quite inconsistent supervisory teams. You know, people naturally move on in their careers, don't they? So sometimes they lose PhD yeah. students. But you know, over a 7-year period, I had a consistent team. It was really, really useful, and they were all really, really supportive. One of the supervisory members got a professorship, and it was still in contact, despite, you know, I can imagine, really heavy work demands. And he didn't really go off the radar either. So now it was really, really supportive throughout the entire process. They were really good.
Well, that's excellent. How much of a gap did you have between submission and the viva? Because I think your viva was February this year, wasn't it?
Yeah, I submitted sometime in the November.
Okay.
So I had quite a while. It was a number of things, really. I think the external examiner, going back to children, he had twins, and Christmas came in. So, you know, we kind of, and I was in no particular rush to push a date, so I was quite relaxed about it. But but it was good to have that gap, to actually have that break from the thesis, so I could then make a better, thorough job of reviewing it.
Yeah, absolutely. So what happened on the day of the viva then?
Obviously, I've never had one before. I probably won't have one again. So it was a strange experience, really. I went up on the train, had a printout of the thesis, sort of carried on the final reviewing bits, and there were a couple of elements that maybe I hadn't prepared for as much as I thought, so I kind of a last-minute rush job in, making sure I'd made some points around certain questions that I was preempting. It was kind of it was just after lunch, so I had lunch with my supervisor, and then we went in, and it started. The questions started. So they'd had a meeting before that, the examiners, and they kind of took it in turns to go through the thesis, if you like. And also to add to it, there was a trainee examiner in there, so there was a third person in there as well, which that person then asked questions as well. So it was kind of...
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there were three people in there, which I was quite comfortable with, to be honest. I thought I'd prepared reasonably well, so I was quite comfortable in someone else asking questions as well. It wasn't too hard on me.
And had you been prompted in advance that this person was
going to
be there?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I knew I was asked if that would be all right. So, I mean, I was happy with that. That's no problem.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Do you remember any of the lines of questioning that they asked you about or anything like
yeah,
that?
Yeah. They initially started off sort of the conceptualisation of it, you know, how's it come about? Arguably, they could be quite lead questions, if you like. They're sometimes quite straightforward to answer, really. So I reflected on, you know, the point of interest and what the study was about. And then, they just took it study by study, really, again, back to kind of theoretical underpinning. How was the second study being informed by the first study? There were some questions on methodology, some technical points. For example, why did you use the statistical test that you did? And those kind of things. Why did you analyse your interviews in this way? And then they sort of, study by study and finding by finding. And then quite a large discussion at the end, towards the end, a large part of the time was spent on my discussions and findings.
And how long was your Viva in total?
Well, it was just over 3 hours, 3.5 hours maybe.
Okay.
So I'm not really sure whether that's a long time or not a long time. It didn't feel like a long time when I was in there. And when I came out and looked at the watch and, I was quite surprised how long it actually was. There were no breaks.
Wow. Okay.
But I think that was probably a good thing. And it was really thorough, forensic almost. Yeah, not in a threatening way, but it was very, very thorough. And they'd clearly read it, which was a good thing for me. They gave feedback throughout, considerations that I could make. It was really, really good. They'd not just scan the document.
3.5 hours is sort of, I suppose it's on the longer side, but I mean, I did a little bit of research a few years ago and I got about 300 responses with people giving me some idea about what their Viva was like and how long and so on. And there was no correlation between the length of the Viva and sort of, the kind of award that was given, whether it was minor corrections or major or whatever.
Right.
Sometimes people have long Vivas. But I think one thing that I've heard a couple of times, and maybe this was true for your examiners as well, I'm guessing it was the case, if they find something they're really interested in, they just won't leave it alone. They kind of want it. They want to talk to the expert, and that's who they've got in the room.
I sense that. I mean, the two examiners were real kind of hardcore academics, really good publication profile, really strong individuals. And I sensed they kind of were interested in it, which was really good for me, and it was a two-way discussion. I was asking them questions as well. It was at times a very challenging experience, but overall a really good experience. Came out really happy, really.
Yeah. And did you get corrections?
Yeah, I got moderate corrections.
Okay.
So straight after the Viva, I went out, had a coffee with my supervisor, and then I went back in maybe half, three quarters of an hour later, and then they gave me some comments and things to address. But yeah, they gave moderate. It was probably about 18 or 19 items to address, which fortunately it was nothing too huge. It was maybe more about, re-emphasise this point there, or can you add a short section here? So I was quite happy to come out with that, to be honest. And I think also with the reputation of Liverpool John Moores, they wanted to ensure it was as good as it could be. So I was quite happy to receive those kind of comments and that volume of comment.
Mm-hmm.
It was really good. And then I had a little bit of a rush job because at that time I was then applying for positions and interviews, and I needed to have things in place prior to being able to accept positions.
Yeah, of course. And how have the last couple of months been then since you've started at Leeds Beckett?
Yeah, I think I interviewed kind of just after Christmas. So I had my Viva date and I started early April. Yeah, it's been brilliant. It's been, I've sort of come from an FE environment where funds are constantly being squeezed. Class sizes are not huge, but you've really got to kind of consider any kind of expenditure or anything like that. And you come to kind of, it's a different world, it's a different industry. So you're still teaching on degree programs, but the scale of it is completely different. The requirement to research is completely different, and the support for research is brilliant. Everyone I've met is really friendly, and the department's great, really good to work for, and they seem to be growing year on year, which is fantastic, really nice place. My commute is a little different. I used to be 2 miles away. I'm now about an hour and 40 door to door, so it's a little bit longer to get here, but I can do some work on the train and things like that. That's been probably the biggest transition, has been the travel, you know. But yeah, students seem great, and I'm just getting involved in kind of planning meetings for next academic year and taking on bits of module leadership and things like that. So yeah, really getting embedded now.
Excellent. Oh, well, that's really great to hear, Tom. I wish you all the best for that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
it's really great to hear someone, particularly because there are so many people who want academic careers, and then it just, you know, there just aren't enough positions in some respects.
Yeah, definitely.
It's really great to hear when someone gets through, when they demonstrate they've got it, and they get their foot in the door.
Yeah,
their foot on the ladder.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I probably had a total of 5 interviews at 3 or 4 different places throughout my PhD journey, and I'm 35, so I'm probably slightly older than your average PhD student in sport related programs. Definitely, I think having had 9 or 10 years of teaching, as well as the PhD, I think that really helped.
Yeah,
you know, because it could have been the case where I had a PhD and no teaching experience. And I think that was probably seen as, you know, someone who can research, but someone who's also demonstrated they can do the job of a lecturer as well.
Yeah.
So I think that really helped me. And also within the year that I was completing, I took on some applied work at a football club. So I think those kind of 3 things, which is the PhD, the teaching, and the applied work in professional football, really kind of, I think that was seen as attractive to them.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. We're almost at the end now, and I know we're under a slight time pressure as well. I've got 2 final questions there, if that's all right. They're just about advice for anyone who's listening. Okay, so first of all, what advice would you give someone who was starting a PhD?
Yeah, starting a PhD is ensure the area that you're interested in is an area that you are really, really interested in. It's going to be quite a long time before thinking about doing a PhD to finishing one, and it takes a lot of persistence to finish one. So I think you've got to be really sure it's an area that you're passionate about, whatever that area is. And I think also is do as much preparatory reading as possible to help shape what your PhD is going to start to look like, really. I probably spent a year, and that's a year's of fees, reading. Whereas if I knew that, I would have probably done a lot more prior to actually even enrolling and even having near enough a good solid proposal or stroke ethics application nearly ready to go, because I probably spent a year just kind of conceptualising what I was going to do. So looking back at it, I'd have done a bit more preparation really before enrolling.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. I'm sure that's going to be useful to people. My last question then is, what advice would you give someone preparing for their visa?
There's quite a few bits, really, that I think work well for me. I found leaving the thesis for a good couple of weeks, depends what your time, the student's time scales are, but it's definitely leave it for a bit so you become less immersed in it. And then once you come to prepare for the visa, is you're able to act as your own reviewer of your own work a little bit better than if you're completely immersed in it. So I think, yeah, leave the thesis for a little bit, have a rest. That'd be one thing. And then certainly speak to supervisors or other people that have recently had vivas, you know, find out their experiences, get a feel for the types of questions you're going to get asked. And the third bit is probably have a good look at who the examiners are, what their research profile is. You might get an inkling that one of your examiners might be more into statistics, so you're likely to get a question about statistics, so make sure you brush up on those kind of things. So it's know your examiners.
Yeah.
So it'd be those 3 things, really.
Well, thank you very much, Tom, for sharing that, but also for sharing your PhD story today. It's been really great to hear about it, and I'm sure the listeners as well wish you all the best as you're starting out in HE.
Yeah, thanks very much. Really enjoyable. Hope that helped.
That's all for episode 61. Many thanks to Tom for joining me today and to you for listening. If you've got any questions or comments, if you want to volunteer to come on a future episode, there are 3 main ways to get in touch. either by commenting directly on the site, which is viva-survivors.com. You can email podcast@viva-survivors.com, or you can find me on Twitter as @ViverSurvivors or @DrRyder. And check out the site as well for details of print books and ebooks on Viva preparation. A recent addition to that is the Viva Prep Handbook, which is a short zine on preparing well for the Viva. Until next time, I'm Nathan Ryder, and thanks for listening.